Which sad are you, old boy? Which sad are you, old man?
This is Deep in Our Hearts. I'm Jan Soule. This one-hour special takes us into the lives of four white women who came of age during the Civil Rights Movement, participated actively in it, and were transformed by it. One grew up in poverty, another in affluence. Two were raised where blacks were treated as subordinates, while another saw her family work for social justice. Why did they defy the color line to join the Southern Freedom Movement?
To have the opportunity to be involved in something so much larger than yourself and to be willing to die for what you believe in is a tremendous gift. It puts everything else that happens afterwards in perspective. I think I became who I was by being privileged to take part in something that was so pure in energy.
My awareness of myself as a white person in a crowd of black people rapidly diminished. Did I think about it in the beginning? Probably I did. But within a few weeks, conscious awareness faded out. And the sensation for me was as if I were melting into the crowd. If I looked at my arm, I would see that I was white. But if I looked at other people, which is really what I was doing much more frequently, I would see people just like me. Or rather, what happened is that I came to feel that I looked just like them. This, of course, was an illusion, and it was sometimes a dangerous illusion.
These stories aren't often heard. Elaine DeLott Baker, Penny Patch, Connie Curry, and Joan Browning were four of many women, black and white, who were in the Civil Rights Movement, or, as they prefer to call it, the Freedom Movement. What made them and others like them decide to become involved in this struggle? There is no single answer, but their stories tell us much about what it was like to be a young white woman in the movement.
Remember, that was pretty heady stuff when you're surrounded by a group of young people who truly believed we shall overcome. We were so sure we were right, you know? Think of the atmosphere. Back then, you've got a John Kennedy who's saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. It's not like things are now where you've got a repressive government, which is not on the side of freedom and things that we're talking about.
It really seemed absolutely the right thing to do. And I never felt so sure that I was doing the right thing. You know, I knew every minute of every day that this is the thing that I need to be doing at this time. And it was a time that my skin color helped, just showing that a white Georgia girl shared a belief with the people who were demonstrating and sitting in and protesting. It spoke more words than in my stuttering I could have said verbally at the time.
The early 1960s were a time of great energy and hope. John Kennedy had been elected our youngest president
ever.
We'll
light our country and all who serve it, and the glow from that fire can truly light the world.
The success of the space program was pushing ideas of limits ever upward. Optimism was in the air for many Americans, but not for all. There were some issues that weren't being discussed by mainstream society. Segregation still held sway in the South. Former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young and historian Julian Bond grew up in the South and worked in the Civil Rights Movement.
An African-American man from the South had almost no rights that were protected. No police officer was going to protect you, no matter what happened. If there was a confrontation with any white person for any reason, you were always wrong. It was still very much segregated. You couldn't use the restrooms in most service stations even, and you couldn't eat in any restaurant.
Well, the South, generally speaking, was an absolute apartheid society.
Historian Julian Bond.
Now, of course, within that larger picture, there were places where the evil wasn't as pronounced. Atlanta, relatively progressive place. Durham, North Carolina, relatively progressive place. Raleigh, Nashville. But when you got away from the big city, when you got away into the rural South, this was a horrific place. Black people lived the best lives they could. You knew that there were two worlds in the South, one black, one white. And the black world was a hard world to live in.
For Connie, Elaine, Penny, and Joan, the issues of segregation were not so pronounced. Connie Curry was the child of Irish immigrants. Until she was 9, she lived in a variety of places while her father worked in the textile industry. When she was in the 3rd grade, they settled in Greensboro, North Carolina.
I look in a way to my upbringing as the daughter of immigrants because I sometimes wonder if their consciousness of being in another country made me more aware of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. There may have been some consciousness that made me know that there was something missing in the segregation, which of course was by law, you know, the legal segregation that I saw all around me. And so I would say that probably my upbringing made me more conscious of being slightly different, which has made me able to move into non-traditional and sort of uncharted roads.
Elaine DeLotte was growing up in a different environment.
This was the 50s when I grew up, and it was very clear. Well, there were about 500 Jewish families in a town of 25,000. We were different because during Passover, we brought matzah and boiled eggs to school.
Her neighborhood, Winthrop, on the outskirts of Boston, was a mix of different immigrant groups. Her parents were second-generation Jewish immigrants.
This was a small town that was primarily Catholic. There were Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics, and there were maybe 25% Protestant and maybe 15% Jews. And they were also a lot of Italian immigrants. We were still dealing with the kind of folklore of the Jews killing Christ. There was no dating between Jews and Christians. So there was very much an awareness of being Jewish and of Jews being different.
Penny Patch also had roots in the North, but most of her early years were spent overseas. Her father was in the State Department, and she grew up in Manchuria, Czechoslovakia, and Germany.
In those years, because of where we lived, I was surrounded by different languages, different cultures. In China, as a child, the people around me spoke English, Chinese, Russian, and German. And I grew up, to a degree, speaking all of those. My parents were always very welcoming of all sorts of people because this was directly in the aftermath of World War II. And from then on, I grew up with stories of the Holocaust from the point of view of the victims. And then later on, equally strong relationships with non-Jewish Germans who participated or watched, or in any case, were German citizens in that time.
When Penny was 9, her parents took her to a place that left a deep impression.
My parents took me to the Dachau concentration camp. You know, I'm not convinced that taking a 9-year-old to Dachau is the greatest thing to do, especially without close attention to the processing of that experience. So I remember standing there in front of the crematorium ovens and thinking about all the children. I had just acquired this information that they were shoveling children into these ovens, and, you know, it was very frightening.
Well, I grew up on a farm in southern Georgia, in southeastern Georgia, in a place that people would not believe now how isolated it was. For example, we didn't have a telephone until my mother got one after I graduated from high school. We didn't have television until after I had gone off to college. So we had county newspapers and radio, a dusk to dawn kind of commercial radio, Johnny Reb radio.
As so often down here, we'll have
Joan Browning was the child of poor tenant farmers who, when she was 4, had used a New Deal program to buy a 58-acre farm. She grew up in a South that was, in many ways, similar to the South that many African Americans knew.
One of the things that most astonishes my black friends from the freedom struggle is the concept that a white girl could pick cotton. We did grow cotton, and one of the routines with cotton is you keep up with how much you pick during the course of the day and you weigh it at the end. I was always really competitive, and I loved the thought, man, I'm going to pick all the cotton in the world. But that summer that I was 11, I picked 100 pounds for the first time. And then by the time I left home at 16, I was picking 200 pounds without any real difficulty.
The South that she knew didn't extend much beyond her two-room school.
So there was a lot about the outside world that we didn't know. There was a lot of sense of community because that's who you were in contact with, and that's what you knew. On the other hand, though, there was a lot of real valuable information about how you incorporate everybody into a community, what you do when people are in need, because there were no strangers. I went to a two-room school. The largest enrollment during the time I was there was 52 students and two teachers. In that whole school district, there was not a single African-American family. The only time I actually had contact with African-Americans was during cotton picking time, because that was the one time that we hired people. So I grew up country, almost unimaginably country to people today.
By 1960, Connie Curry was the first of these four to get involved.
I was quite psychologically and every other way prepared for the movement by 60.
In February 1960, one event seemed to galvanize people's awareness.
A group of 20 Negro students from A&T College.
Sit-ins sprang up all over the South at lunch counters and bus stations. By June, over 70,000 students were involved. As the Atlanta staff person for the NSA, the National Student Association, Connie Curry decided her office could help the students to organize. She and Ella Baker, a legendary civil rights organizer, became the two adult advisors to a newly formed group, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Julian Bond was a student at Morehouse College at the time. He was invited to the first meeting.
We in Atlanta and others, I presume, got a letter from Martin Luther King and a woman named Ella Baker. We didn't know who she was. It invited us to a meeting in Raleigh on Easter weekend 1960 to meet others who had been involved in the movement and to plan future action. And it was a wonderful thing because for the first time we saw these other people who had been doing what we had done in Nashville, in Raleigh, in Durham, in all these other towns and cities in the upper and border South. And so that was our inspiration and the feeling we got at the Raleigh meeting. And I think that's what powered all of us, the feeling that while lunch counters by themselves may have not been the most important aspects of segregation, they were an aspect we could attack.
And so my project, which had been very much geared toward black and white students sitting together in the same room, which was a big deal in itself, to all of a sudden there being an alternative for students taking action and getting out on the street and demanding certain things.
Connie's project, the NSA Southern Student Human Relations Project, was designed to improve race relations in Southern colleges. In 1961, Joan Browning got involved in a different way. At 16, she had gotten a scholarship to the Georgia State College for Women. Always religious, she looked for a church that reminded her of home. She found a small African Methodist Episcopal church that she was comfortable with and began attending services there. One Sunday in the winter of 1960, when she was going to present a program for the children at church, the president of her college called her into his office. Her attendance at the church, he said, was causing anonymous telephone calls inciting violence.
This is just some little dumb country girl going to church. I mean, Lordy, mercy, leave her alone. To think that a dumb little country white girl could cause this black church to be burned down, you know, or the black members of that church or the minister to be harmed, I mean, all because of race and gender. I'd never see myself as a danger to anybody. And in the process of trying to figure out what in the world is wrong with going to a Methodist church, I learned most of what I knew about race.
To go down to the jail and to pray for those that were in prison. Even there that night when Chief McCain said, I'm tired of you niggers.
Religion was one of the forces behind the civil rights movement. Penny Patch.
The role of religion for many, many people was huge. Less so for me. But they got their strength from their religion. I was hugely admiring of that. It was my first experience of religion as a really positive force. I had tended to regard it as something that held people down. And this, in the movement, religion was, by and large, a completely positive force that fueled people's ability to do what they did.
Religion was what fired us up and kept us fired up.
Charles Sherrod was the SNCC coordinator for Southwest Georgia. As a 21-year-old minister in training, he was a key organizer of the Albany movement.
Religion helped us to withstand the dogs as they tore at our clothes, the hoses as they tore our clothes off, the policemen with their billy clubs and their tear gas and all the things that, all of those obstacles that they had that they utilized to break us up were nothing to us because we had our hand in the hand of the loving one.
For me, it was, what am I required to do by virtue of existence? You know, we said we put our bodies on the line. You know, I didn't have anything else to offer except my body. But simply by putting my body in a place, I could say, I really do believe that God loves all of us, that we're all equally created in the image of the eternal. And so I could be a witness. That's what I could do.
We had the beloved community, and they were all fighting together or banding together for equality and justice and freedom. And the community part was that everybody was welcomed.
First of all, I think the beloved community probably means slightly different things to different people. For me, the beloved community is a description of the early years in my experience in SNCC. We were a band of brothers and sisters in this extraordinary effort. We were close to each other. We were very bonded.
Sitting at these SNCC meetings, we would have big disagreements and big arguments. And a lot of people would say that nonviolence, to think it would work as a way of life, was beyond them, that they could not sit and have someone burn cigarettes on their back and love that person at the same time.
Of course, it was complex and imperfect, but given that, we broke down barriers of race, class, region, and were deeply connected to one another. The idea that we were going to do our work nonviolently and create a community of our own that reflected what we wanted to see in the rest of the world.
I used to get sort of bemused by the fact of everybody talking about sexism, how poorly treated women were, because you have to remember there in the beginning, Jane Stembridge, who was the first executive secretary of SNCC, was a white woman, and Ella Baker and me, and we were the three who were, you know, actually running SNCC. I mean, there was the guys who were on the front, like Chuck McDew and Marion Barry and John Lewis, you know, well-known names now. They were the elected officers and the spokespeople always, but it was the three of us who were doing the conferences.
In Augusta, in 1961, at a meeting at the all-black Payne College, Connie Curry and Joan Browning met. Joan Browning and her roommate Faye Powell had decided to attend. They were trying to understand why Joan had been censured for attending a black church, and a minister suggested that they attend the conference. The Payne Conference on Race Relations had been held for about 30 years. This year, the theme was the sit-in movement and Christian students.
The Payne College students had been sitting in for more than a year, since the beginning of the sit-in movement in early 60. And they had never made any progress in Augusta. So they said, well, we've never had white people join us. Would any of you like to go with us? Well, of the 60 or 70 students there, four of us who were white said yes, two white men from Mercer University and Faye and myself. And so that was my very first sit-in.
They sat in at a lunch counter at H.L. Green's drugstore. Around the corner was a barbershop that was a hangout for local Klansmen. Soon, they were surrounded by angry white men.
They focused most of their anger on one of the white men in the group with us, Cecil Hudson, who became Faye's husband later. After what seemed like an eternity Bill Diddley, who was the protest leader from Payne College, came and told us it was time to leave. And so as we were leaving H.L. Green's, these white men were massed on the sidewalk out in front of us, and one of them leapt out of the crowd, and Diddley jumped in front of Cecil and was stabbed in the stomach. He told us to get out of there, and so the four of us who were white ran. That's when I met Connie Curry. She was the designated observer.
You are listening to Deep in Our Hearts.
If you want something, I'll give it to you in a bag and let you go back where you came from. I don't know why you people want to force yourselves on people who don't want to be bothered with you anyway. I wish you would leave. If you don't leave, I'm going to have to call the police.
In December of 1961, Joan joined a group of 9 white and black freedom riders. Their plan was to ride the train together in the whites-only car from Atlanta to Albany, Georgia. Freedom rides had started in 1961 to test if Southern states were in compliance with the Supreme Court ruling against segregation in bus and train terminals. The rides were sometimes dangerous. Attorney General Robert Kennedy had declared that he would ensure that the ruling was enforced. Joan and 8 others decided to see if that was true.
The one place in the South that adamantly refused to obey the ICC ruling was Albany, Georgia. We were prepared to be arrested, but for some reason they didn't arrest us inside the train station, and we were getting into cars and whatnot before they arrested us and set off the Albany movement.
You know, this is a little sleepy town. I think back then it was about 40,000-50,000 people.
As SNCC's field secretary for Southwest Georgia, Charles Sherrod, and 2 other SNCC staff, Cordell Regan and Charles Jones, organized much of the Albany movement.
So this was a big thing for a little town. And so the newspaper were there, the one television station, and so whatever they did to us, would everybody for a good distance would know. And that is the reason why there was a great reaction, you know. We got the news people there. Let's announce a mass meeting tonight. You know, that'll help us out a little bit, knocking on all these doors and passing out all these leaflets. So they help us announce meetings every time we had demonstrations.
Under God, we plan to stay here until it comes.
Our going to jail stimulated the people of Albany to have daily marches. At the end of the week, more than 1,000 people were in jail. It was the first time since the Montgomery bus boycott in 55 that a whole community had been in protest. And it was the first time that that many people had ever gone to jail in America in one community for anything.
We had to fight, although we have to cry.
In the summer of 1962, Penny Patch came from her freshman year at Swarthmore College to join Charles Sherrod's group of SNCC workers in Albany, Georgia. At Swarthmore, she had participated in sit-ins along the eastern shore of Maryland. There, she had met some SNCC members and offered her services. They were really trying to recruit black college students and only took her name and number. In May, she got a call. Their Southwest Georgia coordinator wanted to have integrated groups. Penny was the first white woman to work in a SNCC field project in the Deep South.
Mostly I'd lived overseas. I was a mixture of being really clueless about the details of segregation, not really understanding the danger. But what I did have as a child was this whole exposure to the Holocaust and to what had been done to Jews and to war and destruction and people starving. And so at the same time, I was very protected from the specifics of American racism, but much more well-informed about sort of the suffering world and what had been done to a whole group of people for racist reasons.
Penny was a northerner.
Julian Bond was the publicist for SNCC.
Had a kind of sophisticated, without being stuck up, air about her. Worldly, without being bad about it, if you know what I mean. But had this kind of sophistication that many of us didn't have and wanted to have.
I think I met Penny when I must have been 14, 15 years old. And it was the first association that I had with a Caucasian.
Much of the time she was in Albany, Penny stayed with the Sanders family. Mary was the oldest of six children.
They had no place to stay. And people were reluctant to let the black or the white students stay with them.
I felt like I was just embraced by this community. I mean, they welcomed the SNCC people who came. Not everybody welcomed them. Some people were way too terrified to go anywhere near them. But the people who decided to participate in the movement, you know, took in SNCC people and fed them and housed them and loved them and, you know, made it possible for any of us to continue. And when Sherrod brought this group from the North, which including one white woman, which was me, that same welcome was extended to us.
Well, there were six kids already. A mom, a dad, and a grandmama, and a dog, and a cat. So they were all on the floor everywhere. And of course, after the police found out that they were staying with us, then we had extra company. Extra company in the backyard, on the corner. The police would, you know, wanted to see what was going on.
This was the summer of 62, and Martin Luther King was about to be around, too. He had already had some involvement earlier. There were mass meetings at that point. I mean, the movement was in progress.
There was fear everywhere. And there was fear of death, you know. And we had good reason. These young ladies who work with us, these white girls who came down, they had a legitimate fear of death. Some of them probably even seen somebody come close to death, you know. And so it wasn't a laughing matter. It wasn't nothing to play with. If you were willing to risk your life on the line and share the blows that I knew would come with me, then I'd be happy to have you down here and work right side by side with me, using everything we could use that the system used, you know. The system used if white is right. When a white person says something, you listen to it. So I let a white person tell our people to register to vote. Let's see what happens out of that. That was the logic, and it worked.
But, you know, it also had a kind of negative effect because some Southern black people were so downtrodden and fearful that they would say yes to any white person. So you had a white man or woman saying, can you come to the registration meeting tonight? They'd say, yes, sir. Oh, yes, I'll be there. And you knew they weren't coming. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. But Sherrod is right. In Southwest Georgia, it served as an educational device for both blacks and whites. The blacks learning that all white people weren't evil. There were some who were helpful, who were interested, who were engaged. And for whites to say, you know, there isn't a unified white wall of white supremacy. There are other people in the country who don't look kindly on what Southern whites are doing.
The tenor of things went low. That is, our attendance at mass meetings maybe went down low. And there was no violence, no newspaper ads, nothing to stir up the people. Then I sent a white person in. That would stir up, believe me, stir up the people. It would stir things up, number one, because you'd have immediate integration, something that most of the white people in that county, 99% probably, did not want and would become a table talking issue, a kitchen table talking issue, everybody's tabletop. Not just our people, but the white people as well. But my intention was to stir up our people to come to meetings, to choose to be with us, choose to support us, choose to be a part of the movement, choose to be a part, to participate in democracy.
It's time that we move out of the old ruts of life and begin to contend for the things that all Americans ought to have. All of Albany is now reeling under the impact.
After the mass meetings, the protest marches would begin. They were protesting the segregated facilities. In Albany, blacks had to use side windows and back doors of restaurants. Only one department store offered a restroom to blacks. The Carnegie Public Library and the YMCA were off limits. Hundreds of people would march, and hundreds, black and white, young and old, were put in jail.
But you made one mistake, white folk. You took her children to jail, you see. You made a mistake. And when they did that, all bets were off. Not only did we have the minds of the children, then we had at least a fair shake at the minds of 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds and 60-year-old black people who were scared of white folk, who said, yowza, noza, and went in the back doors, and when they took our children, all bets were off. And I'm no more your slave now. You got my child. You got to turn my child loose. I bet you we had a group of, say about 40 or 50 children, anywhere from 10 years old to 15 years old, who would go to jail over and over and over and over. It took them a long time to catch on to that. These were the same kids they put in their jail. They kept turning them loose. We kept sending them back in.